Hello, and welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast, where we cover the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. I am your host, Eric Mike Storino, coming to you today from Durham, North Carolina. And I am alone today. I am very excited about this, not because I dearly miss Juliet for this recording, but because Juliet can't be here today because she's on maternity leave. I want to congratulate her and her partner, Olivier. They brought into the world a beautiful new son, Arsene Kai Kalhei, and I want to wish them the best in health and great rest during this period. So before we begin, we'd like to remind everyone that if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, and analysis on the Belt and Road Initiative, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Belt and Road Pod. I don't know about you, but when I move outside of my specific Belt and Road or China Watcher bubble and bring up that I have a Belt and Road podcast or what I do for work, you know, the standard response from those outside that bubble is, I don't know what that is. Or if there is an idea, there's actually lots more knowledge of a China-Africa relationship. And you typically hear phrases such as, like, on Bill Maher's show 2 weeks ago, he spoke about China owns Africa now. Or more general sentiment I've heard for over a decade now, you know, China is taking all the resources. Of course, most of you who listen to the show realize the ridiculousness of this type of sentiment. But that said, resource-backed loans have had a decently sized presence within globalizing China's lending makeup for decades now. Sice Carey recently released a new briefing paper on China-Africa lending that was written by Kevin Acker and Devin Brodigan. And they found from 2000 to 2029, 28% of financing from China to Africa was resource-backed. Of course, 70% of these loans were tied to oil in Angola. In fact, resource-backed infrastructure as a whole from China has really lost its cachet in the China-Africa relationship, except in one area, bauxite. In 2019, China produced 35 million metric tons of aluminum. That's more than the rest of the world combined. One of the main raw materials in aluminum is bauxite, something China used to have a great deal of, but now due to lack of domestic supply and trade barriers from traditional exporters in Southeast Asia, for the last about 5 years or so, China has really expanded to West Africa and have signed two major bauxite for infrastructure deals, one in Guinea and one in Ghana. Today, I'm very excited to talk about the latter and maybe a little bit about the former, as I know our guest has done some research in Guinea as well. But I couldn't have better guests to discuss this. Today, we'll have Terrence Neal and Dr. Elizabeth Lossis. Terrence Neal is a natural resource governance researcher and current U.S. District Court judicial law clerk. Terrence received his JD from Harvard Law School in 2019 and his bachelor's degree in public policy from Duke University in 2015. His research focuses on international human rights law, international economics law, and natural resource governance. And he's done field research in Ghana during his time in law school. And Dr. Elizabeth Lossis is a senior fellow at the Duke Nicholas Institute for Environmental Policy Solutions, my old home, and also my old boss. I've been trying to get her on the show for years. And we're here to talk about their new report that was put out by the Duke Nicholas Institute, The Environmental Implications of China-Africa Resource Financed Infrastructure Agreements, Lessons Learned from Ghana's Sino-Hydro Agreement. Terrence and Elizabeth, welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast.
Thanks so much for having us, Eric.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
And a shout out to Juliet for her new baby boy. Very exciting.
It is really exciting. She sent me lots of photos, and it's wonderful. So first, Elizabeth, can you tell us about the Duke Nicholas Institute? The Nicholas Institute published this report. What is its history? What are its goals? And what is its work thus far on Chinese investment?
Well, thanks for the question, Eric. The Duke Nicholas Institute for Environmental Policy Solutions is really a policy think tank within Duke University. And the goal of the Institute is to improve environmental policy making around the world using fact-based research, often coming from within our university or reaching out to scholars, but applying them to real-world problems. Within the Nicholas Institute, I've been there for 4 years, and I have colleagues in the Institute and elsewhere within Duke that are working on issues related to sustainable infrastructure around the world, but we have a particular focus on China's Belt and Road, and particularly the Green Belt and Road, and the opportunity to develop sustainable infrastructure through the Belt and Road. One of the advantages we have at Duke is that we also have a sister university in China called Duke Kunshan University. And so I'm also working with colleagues over at DKU, and I've taught at DKU in their environmental policy program. So we were very excited when Terrence came to us, who has been at Duke, as you mentioned, and was coming off of some work he did at Harvard and wanted to work with us to get this project that he did while at Harvard out. And I was delighted to be the editor. But Terrence is really the driver behind the report, and he did a terrific job.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to cover everything in this report, but it's definitely a must read in my book for how much detail about the agreement is in there. So, Terrence, the report looks at resource finance infrastructure arrangements in the China-Africa relationship. Can you first give us a general overview? You know, what are resource finance infrastructure? And, you know, are they something unique to China? How are they arranged? These types of things.
So resource finance infrastructure agreements, or RFIs, are agreements whereby a host or recipient country pledges future revenues from a natural resource project, like an oil project or a mining project, in exchange for infrastructure financing. So these agreements typically encompass three critical components. And so usually there's one component relating to the natural resource project that's going to be providing the funds for repaying whatever infrastructure loan is awarded. And then there's a component relating to the infrastructure loan. So what will be the repayment terms and things like that. And then there's also a component relating to the actual infrastructure development and construction projects, meaning the parties to the RFI agreements typically lay out the planned projects that they intend to pursue when they undertake the agreement. And so to the question of whether they're unique to China, the answer to that is no, although Chinese entities are the most prevalent investors or lenders in these agreements, particularly the Export-Import Bank of China and the China Development Bank. In the National Resource Governance Institute report on resource-backed loans that came out last year, I believe, there are some examples of the Export-Import Bank of Korea using these types of agreements in their relationship with the DRC. And I believe the agreement there was around copper as the natural resource being leveraged, and the infrastructure was water supply pipelines. So that's one other country or entity that is using these agreements outside of the Chinese context. So in terms of how these agreements are arranged, it's still unclear to me sort of who approaches who. Commence negotiations, for example, it's not clear if it's typical for China to approach an African government that has a natural resource that's interested in to begin negotiations, or whether an African country has an infrastructure need and they reach out to China or a Chinese entity to try to negotiate an agreement. But those are sort of the basics on these agreements.
And so moving to the specific agreement that the report focuses on, can you first contextualize the political and economic circumstances behind the Ghana-Sina Hydro Infrastructure for Bauxite deal? Well, you know, what's the history behind it? When did this happen? What are some of the various interests involved within this project?
So in the report, I mentioned that this Sina Hydro agreement is really combining sort of pre-existing plans to develop an integrated aluminum industry in Ghana with the infrastructure projects that are included in the agreement. So to fully understand that, you have to go back to 2016, 2017. And so in 2016, the current president of Ghana, who is now in his second term, Nana Akufo-Addo, was running to be president. And in his campaign, he promised that he would develop an integrated aluminum sector, meaning that he would develop mines, alumina refineries, which are the refineries that make the intermediary product between aluminum and bauxite, and then also develop aluminum smelters or increase the capacity of the existing aluminum smelter in Ghana. And the idea behind this was that it would bring jobs to help solve youth unemployment issues and also jumpstart the economy, because at the time, Ghana was still participating in an IMF, International Monetary Fund program, that was aimed at increasing its debt sustainability and the sort of macroeconomic situation in Ghana. And so this sort of bauxite component of the deal, one could say, is both Ghana-driven and also China-driven, in that China has an interest in bauxite since it's a major aluminum producer One thing to note, I know you mentioned at the beginning of the show about some of the domestic industry challenges in China. And one aspect of that is that in 2016 or 2017, China was having some serious air pollution issues. And so the government decided that it would cut back on alumina production in China. So in a sense, one could say that perhaps China is offshoring some of the dirtier aspects of aluminum production to West Africa, and those countries being the countries of West Africa being Guinea and Ghana. And then sort of with this backdrop, the vice president of Ghana visited China at an pursuant to an invitation from the Chinese government in 2017. Shortly after, there's a memorandum of understanding saying that China and Chinese entities are going to invest so much money in Ghana to develop the integrated aluminum industry. And then later in 2018 is when we get the Sino-Hydro Agreement being introduced to Parliament and shortly thereafter signed by the government. And then even shortly thereafter, construction began on the road projects that are included in the Sino-Hydro Agreement.
Yeah, can we dig in a little bit deeper in this? You know, what are the terms of the agreement? It's a very large agreement, but, you know, how much money is involved? It is interesting that Sino-Hydro, a state-owned company, but it's state-owned companies within China have certain amounts of autonomy. So the fact that it's state-owned enterprise and the country of Ghana, not a bilateral directly from a Chinese government in Ghana. But do we know anything about the terms of the loan? Are the infrastructure projects, are they predetermined, or is there a pile of money that can be financed to infrastructure projects?
Right. So I guess one thing that is important to flag is that resource finance infrastructure agreements are often sort of multiple agreements. So there's usually a memorandum of understanding or a master framework agreement laying out sort of the general terms of what loan terms will be, what the engineering, procurement, and construction contract terms will be, and the MOUs typically lay out as well the intended or planned projects are going to be. So if the RFI agreement is going to be used to build roads, for example, the road projects that are planned will often be written in the agreement. So in this example with the Sino-Hydro agreement, the agreement lays out that Sino-Hydro is going to be the exclusive engineering, procurement, and construction contractor. And so that means Sino-Hydro is really responsible for the development of all of the infrastructure projects that are planned, and most of the infrastructure projects in this agreement are roads. I can't recall if it's in the Sino-Hydro agreement itself or in a subsidiary agreement, but there's also some local content requirements, so ensuring that Ghanaian companies can also be involved in some of these projects. So in terms of the loan terms in the Sino-Hydro agreement, Sino-Hydro is to arrange $2 billion in infrastructure financing. And so 85% of that is supposed to be loans. And the loan agreements are supposed to have repayment periods of 15 years with a three-year grace period. And the idea is that the three-year grace period will provide Ghana time to produce alumina refineries or mines to help pay back the loans, because Ghana's aluminum industry doesn't currently have the resources to produce the amount of revenues that would be needed to pay back the loans if Ghana actually draws on the entire sort of 85% of that $2 billion number. There's also a fixed interest rate, and then there's a collateral obligations, which I think are quite important. And so with that, Ghana's supposed to develop an offshore escrow account, and that escrow account is supposed to hold all of the government income that's brought in from the sales of alumina. And this account is not supposed to fall below a certain level, or it could lead to a default on the agreement. And the idea is that this escrow account will cover for when production or prices are not high. So if Ghana's not producing as much income as it would like to be meeting its loan requirements, they'll have this escrow account, which could cover payments sort of in those down periods.
And where does the money from the escrow account come from? Is it just Ghanaian sovereign funds?
So the money for the escrow account is to come from whenever there's an alumina refinery built, when that alumina is eventually sold on the international market, whatever royalties or tax income that the government will get from that, that's supposed to go into the escrow account. In terms of default terms, it can be potentially harsh because if Ghana defaults on the loan, Sinohydro can order the payment of all outstanding loan balances and also seize the escrow account. So once there's money in the escrow account, there's a potential for it to be lost if Ghana is not regularly meeting its repayment obligations.
And for like the sales of bauxite, does it pay off on the equivalent of like the spot market price for whenever it's sold? Because I know that's one thing that got Angola in big trouble because they took out however many billions of dollars for resource for infrastructure loans, for oil for infrastructure loans when the price was $120 a barrel and it went down to $40 a barrel. They were in not good position. Do you know if it's the same with the bauxite prices and in terms of how it's paid and if that's pegged or if there's a floor of which Sinohydro will pay for a certain amount of bauxite?
Yeah, so it's to clarify, I don't know if it's, and I don't believe it to be the case that Sinohydro is going to be the purchaser or that all bauxite is intended to go to China. I think that likely the majority would end up going to China since it is such a major consumer of bauxite. But I think just the idea is that whoever is the ultimate purchaser of the bauxite, the income from that sale would then go to paying back the infrastructure loans. And on the point of how bauxite is actually priced at the point of sale, I'm not 100% sure on that.
Okay. And, I think as per usual, I love really getting into the details before this kind of the bigger picture is established for our listeners. So what is the current status of Ghana's bauxite mining and bauxite industry and the alumina smelters and the Sinohydro built infrastructure?
Yes, so Ghana, before it signed the deal and today, sort of there hasn't been much change, only had one bauxite mine, and that mine has been around since colonial times, and now it is jointly owned by the government and a Chinese company called Bozai Mineral Groups, I believe. And then there's one government-owned aluminum smelter, and that smelter is not running at full capacity currently, but there are plans to retrofit it so it can run at a higher capacity and produce more aluminum. And so notably, there's no alumina refinery yet, and that is sort of a major part of this deal in that the offshore escrow account for collateral is supposed to be funded by alumina sales. So Ghana's kind of a bit behind in that it's already beginning to benefit from the loans, or the loans are already being drawn upon to build roads. But Ghana hasn't made much progress in the past few years on actually getting an alumina refinery built or even new bauxite mines or alumina smelters, if it has to do that. And so in terms of the Sinohydro projects, shortly after the Parliament approved the Sinohydro agreement, it approved some subsidiary agreements, particularly the deferred payment agreements, which are essentially loan agreements, where the Parliament essentially agreed to pay for the 10 road projects that are valued at around $646 million. And the Parliament also approved the EPC contracts for those as well. And so construction began on at least 4 projects in 2019. And those are expected to be 30 to 60% complete and are likely to be fully complete as early as next year. So things are moving quite quickly. And then there's a plan for a second batch of projects to go online at some point. But I think that's been delayed because of COVID. I read recently this year that the government announced that they may have a partner for the alumina refinery. And it's going to be likely Bozai Minerals Group, which is a group that I mentioned that owns the existing bauxite mine in Ghana. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because this year is the first that I'm hearing of that development, but there isn't much news around that. And then in terms of the plan for moving forward, GEODEC, or the Ghana Integrated Aluminum Development Corporation, which is a state-owned corporation that has a mandate to develop aluminum industry projects and related infrastructure, has said that they're likely to develop up to 3 new bauxite mines, up to 3 new alumina refineries, and potentially 1 new aluminum smelter. And state-owned enterprise is likely to own a minimum of 30% stake in those projects, along with private investors. So to be seen on who those investors are, how those projects go forward. But in terms of the environmental implications that I think we'll discuss later, some of those planned projects are major points of concern about how this agreement will be executed.
Yeah, so they signed this $2 billion agreement, and part of it was three major bauxite mines, if I'm correct, and also these alumina refineries. And so there's been about $600 million in road contracts signed, and they're already about 60% built, and there hasn't been an expansion to any new bauxite mines or any beginning of development for an alumina refinery. Is that correct?
Right. So I believe there's some early development on the mines, but there isn't much development in the way of the alumina refinery. So mining roads and testing has been done on mining sites. So all the signs indicate that those mines will go forward. There's just no sign currently of who the investors are to take those forward with Salem Corporation. And so sort of at the speed that the government seems to be going forward on those now is why many environmentalists are concerned about whether the government has been diligent in terms of the environmental assessment and environmental planning for those.
Yeah, and absolutely. As you mentioned, Terrence, you know, these mines, there are pushbacks from local communities, civil society organizations, because of its environmental concerns within the country. Elizabeth, in terms of the potential expansion of bauxite mining in this Ghana-Sinohydro deal, what are the already current and potential environmental implications of this expanded bauxite mining in Ghana?
Well, Eric, we know that bauxite mining is quite a dirty type of mining. We know from what Terrence already told us that China actually closed down some of its alumina refineries because of the pollution they caused. There's a lot of particulate dust, red bauxite dust, created in the mining itself, and then also other pollutants from the other processing of the bauxite. But actually, at the mining site, the red bauxite dust is incredibly thick, and it's a strong pollutant irritant. It affects the eyes and the respiratory system of people living in the area. It leads to cardiovascular health problems. It was an enormous problem in Guinea. You mentioned earlier that there's an area particularly important bauxite site in Boké in Guinea, where there was a lot of pushback from a lot of the air quality issues created. But there are also other issues as well. Water is a big concern. You get a lot of toxins in the water. And in a place like Ghana, 25% of the population depends on surface water for their drinking, their washing, their cooking. And the release of heavy metals into the water is serious enough that I know in Ghana, the locals won't drink the water after a big storm when there's been a surge of water. And in Malaysia, they had such serious concerns, they actually shut down. They did a ban on bauxite mining for 3 years because of the water concerns. Then they're sort of scaling up. There is also great concern about deforestation, the mines themselves and also the refineries and the smelters require clearing of forests and removing the soil. In the case of Ghana, the places where they're most likely to put these mines in are two reserves, in particular the Ottawa Forest Reserve, but also the Tana Ofin Forest Reserve, which contain some of Ghana's last remaining tracts of biodiversity-rich tropical upland rainforests. And these are really very special natural treasures for Ghana. And it's very likely that mining would be devastating, which has brought a lot of attention, in particular from Ottawa, in Ghana, but also internationally. That it even got to the level that Leonardo DiCaprio started tweeting about it and sort of raised this onto the global scale. So the ecosystem services from the deforestation, from the biodiversity loss, affect the local communities that depend on a lot of this plants and animals, but also the country and globally. And then there's also continuing to scale up the impact on the climate. We all can imagine these smelters, you know, spewing out terrible greenhouse gases. But even just that global deforestation, the local deforestation I mentioned also contributes to carbon emissions increasing. But the issue isn't just the impact on the global climate. It's also the local climate. As they continue to cut down these forests, it actually affects the agriculture. It leads to decreased participation, extended drought, and drought severity. So there's enormous disruption, if not well planned and executed and cited. And then finally, really back to the human level, the health of the communities around is really put at risk in the water and the air, but also in a place like Guinea, there was a lack of electricity around the mines, even as electricity was being sent into the manufacturing areas. And there was also expropriation of rural lands in Guinea, and the expectation in Ghana is that there is going to be some ancestral lands taken away. These are all problems with bauxite mining around the world, but are known issues that people in Ghana are already concerned, and they haven't even started.
Absolutely. But with this, this certainly is the case that bringing in not only $2 billion for infrastructure, transport infrastructure that's sorely needed within Ghana, the direct economic benefits of the mining, but also it's one of the few resource for infrastructure deals that also has industrial upgrading, which is a big part in many developing countries, including Ghana, being able to not only be the here's a raw material, I'm going to export this, but you're actually creating, you know, alumina refining and industrial capabilities. And also on an environmental level, you know, bauxite is going to be so important for, bauxite is so important for aluminum, and aluminum is going to be very important for, if it's not already important, for the next generation of electronic vehicles and clean transportation. And we know transportation and the fossil fuels and the gas and oil that goes into our planes, trains, and automobiles, turning that into clean electric battery-powered transportation is going to be so important for our climate mitigation. So what can be done about mitigating these terrible environmental and social damages that come from the bauxite industry? And what could Ghana do or Ghanaian officials do?
That's a great point, and I'm really glad you brought it up. I want to be clear that by pointing out these potential risks from mining, environmental and social risks, I am not in any way saying that Ghana and other countries shouldn't go ahead and develop. The real aim is for them to develop them well. And that requires doing an environmental and social assessment of the projects before they go forward. Now, every country in the world has set up something called an environmental impact assessment, and these have been around for about 50 years. They're called EIAs, and typically what happens is as you get through the project cycle and you get close to the point of finalizing the plans and get ready to start building, most projects, big projects, will be required to undergo one of these EIAs. The problem is that a project is often so far along that it's hard to make changes at that point because everybody is invested in the project going forward. They put all their financial and political capital into it. So by the time EIAs occur, if they even are undertaken, you often just get projects tweaked a little here or there. They're almost never halted at this point from an EIA, and they're often barely adjusted to really address the harm. So in the last 10 to 20 years, I'd say the global community has realized that the real way to both address these environmental and social risks, but also allow development to occur for something like bauxite or many, many other different types of economic activities is do what they call a strategic environmental assessment in the very early stages when you're setting up policies and plans and programs, but before you've got to the point of selecting individual projects. And think about, for example, if you had a bauxite mine and you did a big study of the entire country to say what is the amount of bauxite that we could remove in a sustainable fashion that would allow communities, human communities, to prosper and not jeopardize biodiversity or climate or whatever, and where would we put them, and what would be the rate of that we would develop these resources, et cetera. And then you pick the sites, and then you pick the levels, and you find the companies that are able to appropriately take on those different projects. Ghana actually, and I'm going to let Terrence take over from here, Ghana actually has some good strategic environmental assessment requirements, laws in their country, which are actually quite progressive for Africa. They are sort of ahead of the game, and yet still this opportunity to use an SEA seems fraught with problems in this particular case. So I'm going to actually hand it over to Terrence to speak specifically about Ghana.
What are the specific, you know, environmental laws, regulations within the bauxite mining industry for, you know, either strategic environmental assessments or environmental impact assessments or otherwise?
So the two main laws relevant to environmental assessment in Ghana are the Environmental Protection Agency Act and the Environmental Assessment Regulations. And so on the strategic environmental assessment front, Ghana has a history of undertaking strategic environmental assessments, often partnering with European development agencies or other institutions to conduct them. For example, in 2012 or 2013, Ghana conducted a strategic environmental assessment of its offshore oil and gas industry and did a really good job with that. And the laws in the book, so the environmental assessment regulation, says that environmental assessment should be required for government plans and programs. And so some EPA lawyers or Ghanaian EPA lawyers have interpreted that to mean that strategic environmental assessment is actually a requisite for the government whenever they're developing plans or programs. However, some people debate that because although the laws have that language, they don't really lay out a specific framework for conducting strategic environmental assessment, meaning that there is no specific procedures for strategic environmental assessment on the books. In comparison, for environmental impact assessment, there are more specific procedures. And so essentially what's happened here, I believe, with the Sinohydro agreement and the related aluminum sector projects is that the government has seized on this ambiguity and has thus far not conducted a strategic environmental assessment, and they don't seem to plan to do one. And so, as Liz pointed out, would have been ideal for the government to, at the outset, sort of conduct strategic environmental assessment and figure out where would be the best place to place mines and to develop a plan to manage or mitigate potential environmental risks. But so far, they haven't done that. And that's why environmentalists are concerned, and that's why we expressed concern in the report, because while the government is saying that the projects will not create substantial environmental harms, there's no way for them to truly know that unless they undertake a systematic environmental assessment of the overall aluminum industry developments. So for the environmental impact assessment, those will be required for individual projects. But as Liz mentioned, those assessments occur too late in the game. So the government has already started developing the infrastructure for particular mining sites, and they've all but said those mining projects at those sites will go forward. So more or less, what we predict is that perhaps those projects will be tweaked around the margins, or there'll be programs aimed at reducing risk. But the reality is, it may just be too risky to mine for bauxite in the Tewa Forest, for example. There may be no sustainable way to actually mine there. And that's what a strategic environmental assessment would have been able to reveal to the government early on. And so it'll be interesting to see how the government goes forward with that.
Yeah, absolutely. On top of what you've already stated, you know, my reading of your report, I found the general thesis of it was that RFIs can, you know, lead to an investment climate that can further incentivize the direct short-term economic interests in a project over environmental regulations or laws, long-term financial sustainability, and or ecosystem services. Can you expand on that idea? I mean, how does the resource for infrastructure portion intensify these interests as above what a normal, you know, Belt and Road project would be?
So I guess it's important to consider that RFI agreements are really a combination of two types of projects. There's an infrastructure component, and then there's a natural resource component. And here, the report is really focusing on countries meeting their critical infrastructure needs. So if we look at other models of infrastructure finance, for example, the project finance model, generally the projects that are being undertaken have to be able to produce sufficient revenue in the future to actually cover their costs. For example, if there's a toll road, there's an expectation that the toll road is going to eventually pay for the cost of building that in the future. And so I think that probably doesn't carry the same risk that we're seeing with the resource finance infrastructure agreement, where essentially perhaps it's the case that countries are getting infrastructure these agreements that wouldn't normally produce sufficient revenues. For example, the toll road model may not be as successful or optimal in the developing country or emerging market in comparison to a country like the US. So now we're sort of using other means of finance to pay for that infrastructure. And in this case, it's going to be aluminum projects. And so I think once the government, sort of at the outset, when they're concluding these deals, goes big on the value of the infrastructure projects they want to undertake, and here it's sort of $2 billion. And then there's uncertainty around what the natural resources are actually going to produce or their value. And so, you know, within 2 years, you get the roads that are completed. And then within that 2-year process, perhaps the government begins to realize that the bauxite or whatever other resource they're planning to leverage doesn't actually produce the amount of income that they thought it would. And so I think that sort of creates a situation where the government has to double down almost on the natural resource because they don't generally have other sources of income to pay for their infrastructure loans, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's actually kind of shocking that, you know, Sino Hydro has gone ahead and has already gone 60% plus on, you know, 600 whatever million dollars in construction already when the mines haven't even opened yet. And so just that added, when Ghanaian government is going to have to come up with the money to pay back that $600 million, it means that, and you're already behind, it means there's just so much pressure to do anything to cut corners and to make the project go ahead faster, which could certainly mean foregoing environmental laws or regulations. So your report concludes with different recommendations for different entities within the Ghana-Sino-Hydro agreement. So this is for both of you. What are some of these, the top recommendations that you have? You know, you had some for Ghanaian policymakers, for Sino-Hydro and its lenders, and also for GIADEC, which is, we didn't go too much into it, but it's the Ghanaian state-owned alumina company. So can you give a synopsis of some of the most important recommendations that you have for these entities?
Sure. So I'll start with the recommendations for Ghanaian policymakers. So they're kind of in two categories. So the first being targeted at taking a step back and assessing the risks before moving forward with additional aluminum or moving forward with aluminum industry projects, particularly those planned to be placed in the Taylor Forest Reserve. So we recommend that the Ghanaian Parliament should not approve additional loan agreements or EPC contracts until the government has actually systematically examined the environmental and social risks related to developing the planned aluminum industry projects, and also actually going to communities and having hearings and consultations that align with international standards, which have not occurred so far. And we believe that halting the approval of these contracts and loan agreements would ensure that Ghana doesn't draw on the full value of the infrastructure loan before they take into account risk, because as we've mentioned, that may lead to the worst case scenario with regard to environmental and social risks materializing. And then another type of recommendation we have for policymakers are future looking, because Ghana also wants to develop an integrated iron and steel industry, and it's unclear yet whether they're going to connect that to infrastructure financing. But we think that the government should be prepared to deal with that and prepared to have a system in place for proactively assessing environmental risk before taking on another big loan that they may not be able to repay in the end. And I think Liz has some thoughts on the recommendations for the Chinese entities involved, particularly the lenders in Sino-Hydro.
Right. From a Sinohydro and the lender's perspective, it's somewhat similar. We strongly encourage them to pressure Ghana to undertake a strategic environmental assessment and to actually try to identify the potential environmental and social impacts and figure out how to address them, and even go as far as helping fund the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency of Ghana, in undertaking this SEA. You might ask, why would Sinohydro want to slow down what will be the payments coming back to them? It seems a little counterintuitive, perhaps, but it really isn't. If you remember what I was talking about in Guinea, there is really a big concern that there's going to be continuing delays and unrest. And even in the case of Ghana, there have already been protests, but in Guinea, they went all the way to the capital, and there was quite a bit of destruction over this, which is going to add further costs to the project. And the final thing, which is wrapped up in all this, is there's reputational risk to Sinohydro into China in general. And Eric, you know from all the work you've done on the Belt and Road, these investments, an important part of them is this sort of soft power relationship. And if a project is really going to go sour and create a lot of national and international protests and reputational risks, it really is not in the best interest of Sinohydro or the other lenders or the government of China itself.
And then the report ultimately ends with some recommendations for the potential or prospective joint venture partners for Geodec or the Ghanaian Integrated Aluminum Development Corporation. And those joint venture partners are supposed to help Geodec develop the mines and alumina refineries that are going to help Ghana repay back the infrastructure loans. And really, this recommendation is targeted at the fact that corporations have responsibilities under international law to respect human rights. And there's also just generally today pressure and a desire from investors and regulators and the public for corporations to do more when it comes to environmental and social aspects of their operations. And so it's really in any potential joint venture partner's best interest to be diligent when it comes to sustainability issues and human rights issues when planning a potential or planned mining projects or aluminum projects, because it could impact our bottom line in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Terrence, Liz, this has been such a pleasure having you on the show. Will you stick around for recommendations?
Sure.
Sounds good.
Great. You've been listening to the Belt and Road podcast. Remember, if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, and analysis, and please join in on the discussion, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Belt and Road Pod. Again, the paper we've been discussing today is what's published from Duke's Nicholas Institute. It's on their website. We'll put it in the show notes. The title is The Environmental Implications of China-Africa Resource Finance Infrastructure Agreements, Lessons Learned from Ghana's Sinohydro Agreement. And it's an absolutely big recommendation on my end. But let's hear from you all. Liz, do you have a recommendation for our listeners today?
Sure, Eric. I read a really interesting new report out last week from the Council of Foreign Relations. It was a report I was actually a little surprised to read, an independent task force put together a report called China's Belt and Road Implications for the U.S., chaired by Jacob Liu and Gary Rohed. And it is a really thorough and interesting report. I'd say it's a very accurate view of how the U.S., the sort of mainline U.S., views the Belt and Road. I think a lot of listeners to your podcast may not agree with all of their findings, but will certainly find it interesting. And I think in particular, some of the top line recommendations are a little strident, but as you get deep into the report, you'll find that it's a bit more nuanced. And so whether you agree with it or not, it's definitely worth a read.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I got about a third through it. I definitely plan to finish it, but it really goes in depth, and it's a wonderful read. So a second recommendation. Terrence, do you got any recommendations for our listeners?
So my recommendation is related to my pandemic coping strategy, I guess you can say. I'm fortunate to live in Florida, so it's warm generally. So I bought a bike and I've been biking a lot at the state parks here. And so I guess my recommendation would be, if you want to get outside, get some cardio, biking has been a good way to do that for me and also to get to see the local area. So I guess this is the plug for bikes.
Here, here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, some wonderful trails there in Florida. Huh, you've inspired me. I need to get outside more. Usually I'd like to recommend something fun, but there's been such a plethora of really incredible reports that have come out, including the CFR report Liz mentioned earlier, but two in the last couple of days on Chinese lending. First was through a carrier, I cited this at the beginning, Kevin Acker and Deborah Brodigan had 20 years of data on China's Africa lending. It's a great synopsis of the last 20 years of China-Africa lending and the trends. And it's a good complement to a report that came out today from Aid Data and a few other entities called How China Lends, a Rare Look into 100 Debt Contracts with Foreign Governments. And it is going to be a seminal report in Belt and Road studies. It is really incredible. Somehow they got their hands on 100 debt contracts from Chinese entities, mainly the Exim Bank and China Development Bank and a few state-owned commercial banks. And it's this giant cross comparison between other bilateral lenders and multilateral lenders in terms of how contracts are actually structured and what terms are in it. And it had some really novel new data and information in it, including one thing that rather shocked me is that some of like China Development Bank contracts have cross default clauses to any adverse action a debtor country takes to any PRC entity, even if the entity is outside of the current contract or loan. And so they gave an example in Argentina had a $2 billion loan for a railway and two other loans for two hydro projects. And Argentina wanted to cancel the hydro projects for environmental reasons, but China Development Bank threatened to stop lending on the railway if they pulled out. And so there's just so much detail and it's lots of new information and it's just absolutely must read. So I'll put it in the show notes. Terrence, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us on the Belt and Road podcast.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you for having us on.
It was a pleasure.